danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 251 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Owings Mills, Maryland, I am Andrew Brokus. By myself for the introduction and strategy segment today. But don't worry, ladies, Nate Mavis will be joining me for the interview. And our interviewee today is Helen Ellis. If you listened to our interview with Doug Wider a few weeks back, Helen's name came up. She is a proud housewife. She is the author of two novels, Eating the Cheshire Cat and The Turning Book. She is also the author of the short fiction collection, American Housewife, and the Twitter account, What I Do All Day. You also may have seen there was a thread about Helen on 2+2. She was featured in a New York Times article for her interest in poker. And, you know, we'll talk to her about being a sort of, I don't know if it's quite fair to call her a society lady, but, you know, these are some poker games that I don't know if we've talked too much about on the show before, but she has done a lot to introduce some of her, you know, kind of in a very casual way, friends to poker, but she herself is a more serious poker. She also coached Colson Whitehead when he was preparing to play the World Series of Poker. She helped him out some. So for those of you who are familiar with his book about the World Series of Poker, this is the Helen from that particular book. Of course, we do have, maybe not of course, but we do have a strategy segment for you before we get on to the interview. And the strategy segment is presented by Tournament Poker Edge. Lots of great stuff on Tournament Poker Edge. Two recent video series that I can recommend to you. One of them is, I can recommend it because it's mine. So this is a review of hands that I played in the $3,500 main event of the World Poker Tour at Maryland Live. And it's really a wide variety of players there. Some really, really tough opponents, some very, very weak opponents, and a lot of opportunities to see me doing some pretty exploitive things. And you know, just how I'm changing my play in a live venue, taking into account, you know, reads and stuff like that, and also changing my play against tough players versus weaker players and that sort of thing, both, you know, times where I do that well, times where I wish I'd done it better. A lot of stuff in there that I think is pretty interesting. That's a series that I'm proud of. I've also been watching and enjoying myself Matt Hunt, former guest on this show, has a series on there about simplified continuation betting strategies, where he's using a solver to talk about how to kind of take a solver output, which can be very complicated to look at, and use that to construct a strategy that you can actually employ at the tables. And I think he comes across some correct but kind of unconventional strategies that many people probably aren't realizing right now are correct. And I'm personally enjoying that one myself, and I think that many of you would benefit from it as well. And all of that and much, much, much more is available at tournamentpokeredge.com. Strategy hand coming to us from Todd. Todd says, I've been playing this extremely passive 1-2 table for a few hours. I have the whole table covered, and I have an aggressive image from raising a huge range of hands in position. I'm constantly raising over limpers and often taking pots down preflop or with a continuation bet, yet I've managed to not show any junky hands. The table has not adjusted or tried to combat this, with the exception of one player who is older and has 3-bet squeezed my raise a couple of times. I deem him very competent, and I watched him 3-barrel ace high only to get caught by a stubborn calling station. Villain in question, i.e. the villain in this hand, not the older player he was just describing, the villain in the hand we're about to discuss, also took note of that 3-barrel and commented to the older guy that he, the villain in question, did not himself have the balls to triple barrel. Villain is a, quote, pro who frequents Atlantic City and other tournament series. He has a large poker-themed tattoo on his hand. He talked a little about playing 2-5, seems super tight aggressive. The villain straddles. This is the second or third time in a few hours that he's straddled, and Todd raises ace queen of diamonds to $16 from middle positions. This is 1-2 game. I imagine the straddle was to 4. Todd opening to 16 with ace queen suited middle position seems good. Gets 2 callers, and then the villain raises to $40. And Todd says, I look at his stack, and I see what looks like 60-ish in red, plus a $100 bill. And this is going to end up being an issue because it turns out the villain has 200 bills. It's actually been a while since I've played at a casino that allowed you to keep cash on the table. Most places have stopped doing that, or, you know, bills don't play. I believe that you're allowed to clarify how many bills the player has. I know this can be frustrating sometimes, trying to ask what a player has, and, you know, they're not required to count their stack down for you, although they are required to, you know, make it visible. And you can generally ask, like, how many large denomination chips they have or something. And I think this is an important thing to get clear on. I think you should ask how many bills the person has, or ask them to spread out their bills or something like that, because, of course, it is relevant here whether the opponent has $100 or $200 in bills. If we were to go with Todd's initial assumption that the villain is only playing $160 to begin with, in a straddled game, right, this is a 1-2-4 game now, this villain is only playing about 40 big blinds, and there's already two people who have called this raise. So the two people who put in the $16, that's $32 in basically dead money. I doubt those players ever have a hand better than ace queen that you have to worry about. Where I'm going with all this is, if you believe the villain's only playing a $160 stack in the first place, I'm pretty sure you just want to ship it here with ace queen suited. It's an extremely good hand. It blocks a bunch of the hands that it doesn't want to run into. It has decent equity even against strong calling ranges. Like, even if you're called by, like, kings, your ace queen suited is not in terrible shape against it. There's a lot of money already in the pot. And if the villain really only has 160 behind, you're not risking that much to shove. You're also quite interested in freezing those two callers out of the pot, right? Because when you call with ace queen suited and you let them overcall with hands like pocket fives and 10-8 suited, or like those kinds of hands, you really don't benefit much from allowing those players to overcall with those sorts of hands. So if the villain is only playing 160, I think you just want to shove here and get it in pre. I understand that this player seems like, you know, super tight aggressive, and I mean, I know a lot of you guys are going to be playing a lot more 1-2 than I am. I do understand that you don't see a lot of 3-betting in these games, and his sizing is kind of suspicious. That it's like 16 and 2 calls, and he's only making it 40. I mean, there's a lot of things here that feel strong, and I'm not saying you should just shove here willy-nilly, but ace-queen suited is not willy-nilly. Like, if you have king-queen suited and you call here, fine, that's probably good. The queen-jack suited, certainly I'm just calling. Like, 10s, I'm just calling. 10s actually is going to do much worse, I think, as an all-in here than ace-queen suited is. It's going to run into pairs that dominate it way more often than ace-queen suited is. Ace-queen suited, I think, is just, even if you kind of have a hunch that the villain is strong, ace-queen suited is still a really good hand to just get it in with. I mean, the villain might end up just having jacks or something. Who knows? I mean, sometimes you see people make crazy folds, too. Like, maybe the guy shows you ace-king and folds. I mean, if he's really that nitty, like, maybe he doesn't want to get it in pre with ace-king. I think occasionally some really good things, not often, but occasionally some really good things can happen if you shove, in addition to just, you know, taking it down pre or even getting a heads up against that other the three better with $32 in dead money in the pot is a pretty nice outcome if you're only risking 160. But yeah, so Todd ends up calling, and he actually doesn't say whether the other two players call behind. It seems like they don't, because we go to the flop with $112 in the pot, Todd says. So it seems like the two callers actually folded. It's very hard to imagine that was correct given the price that they were getting. I mean, that certainly helps in terms of making this call profitable. And, you know, as it turns out, the villain does have $200 bills, which would make me a lot less excited about getting all in with ace-queen suited pre, although I still don't think it would be terrible. But, knowing the villain has $200 bills, I feel better about the call. And, you know, retrospectively, knowing that those two guys in between are going to fold, calling is somewhat more appealing also, because part of the value of 3-betting, I was thinking, was pushing those two out of the pot. Todd also says, I call with a plan to c-bet most boards, and there's a good chance we'll be playing for his stack. And I'm a little unclear what exactly he means by this. You know, Todd's not going to be able to see betmost boards because Todd is not the final preflop aggressor. So the villain is going to be the one c-betting, or at least having the opportunity to c-bet. Villain also is out of position, so he'll be acting first after the flop. Not that that's a bad thing, but I'm just not really sure what he means by planning to c-bet most boards. And, I mean, I do think it's good that Todd's recognizing at this point there's going to be a stack-to-pot ratio, or he's thinking stack-to-pot ratio of 1 on the flop, and he's going to be getting it in most of the time with ace-queen anyway, which is why you want to just be getting it in pre. Like, if you're acknowledging there's a good chance we're going to be playing for a stack anyway after the flop, why let him see that flop? Why let those other two players in the middle potentially see that flop? Like, just get it in pre if you know you're going to be getting it in after the flop most of the time anyway. You know, ace-queen, even with an SPR of 1, ace-queen can be sort of a tricky hand to play. You know, you have to stack off on a lot of boards that you're not going to love stacking off on, and then there's some boards that maybe you don't stack off one, but it feels crappy, like 8-7-6 with 3 clubs and the villain shoves. You know, are you stacking off with ace queen suited there? You know, he could still have worse, or he could have a hand that you have a lot of equity against, like pocket tens without a club, you know, where you really hate to fold ace queen of diamonds there getting 2-1. So I think you are not really doing yourself any favors by seeing the flop here, but I do think it's good that you're acknowledging that you're going to be priced in on a lot of boards, including some that are not obviously good for ace queen of diamonds. Anyway, go to the flop, $112 in the pot, heads up with this super tight aggressive villain. And the flop is ace of spades, king of clubs, six of spades. Villain checks, Todd says, I bet $70. It's not, now obviously this is an extremely good flop for ace queen. However, it's not entirely clear to me what you're accomplishing by betting. I think this is a board that pretty heavily favors the preflop three better, even though in this case it ended up being really good for your hand. This is a really static board. You know, there's a few gut shots, but other than that, there's not really draws. You know, there's no way, like, when you have a pair of aces, there's really no particularly bad turn card for you. So I don't think betting this flop is actually that important. I think whatever hands, you know, our second bet, like, if the villain has, say, ace-jack, you should be able to get stacks in anyway. You don't really need to bet the flop. I don't think you're protecting against anything particularly important by betting the flop. Like, I don't think fault equity is really worth anything to you here. And I'm not sure that you're really going to be in such good shape against his range of hands that wants to get money in here. Like, even though this is a good flop for ace-queen, I'm not sure, like, I don't think you have a clear value target, basically. I don't think there's a lot of hands worse than yours that the villain is going to be three-betting and then checking on this board with the intention of getting in. Like, I kind of think when he checks here, it's either a trap or he thinks this is a very bad flop for him. In neither case do you really benefit much by betting ace-queen. Like, if it's a really bad flop for him, you don't mind giving him a free card, and if he's trapping, well, you're probably going to be stacking off to him anyway, but I don't think you're doing yourself any favors by betting the flop. So I would encourage you, rather than just saying, like, oh, this is a good board, or I knew I was going to get it in preflop, you still want to be thinking about what are you actually accomplishing by betting the flop, especially making such a large bet of, you know, over half the pot and over half of the effective stack. I think even if you're going to bet here, you want to bet a much smaller amount, like $30 or something, where you're kind of, if you were bluffing here, like, let's say you had 8-7 of spades, or, you know, even better, 8-7 of clubs, because 8-7 of spades is a flush draw. Let's suppose you had 8-7 of clubs, and you kind of wanted to bet here to put pressure on hands like queens and jacks that might be in the opponent's range. I don't think you need to bet anywhere near $70. I think you can bet something like $30 on the flop and still put a lot of pressure on those hands, because this is a really bad flop for queens or jacks. And of course, when you actually have a big hand, like if you flop a set or you flop ace queen or something like that, you also don't need to make a large bet because you're so shallow. Just some smaller bets will enable you to get in. So take advantage of the fact that the stack to pot ratio is so low and you don't need to make large bets to build the pot. Take advantage of that to find some checks and find some smaller bets would be my advice. So I would like to check here. Todd bets 70, and this is when he learns that the villain has $200 bills. So the villain check raises all in, and Todd realizes now that it's actually $140 more, so 140 on top of the 70 for Todd to call. And Todd says, I start counting out my chips, because that had been my plan all along, but the villain was suddenly talkative. Not in a taunting way, but in a jovial way, and I thought back to his comment about not having the balls to three barrel. I decided I was either crushed or against a high equity draw at best, and I folded face up. I think this is really good discipline on Todd's part to remain open to new information, even though he goes, into the flop with a plan, and obviously the plan was based on, you know, in fact, thinking that there were somewhat different stack sizes than there are, but he goes into the flop with a plan and the understanding that he's going to be stacking off a lot, and then he gets a flop that seems really good for him, and then he bets, and now he's getting a really good price to call, but still, he's not treating it as a trivial decision, right? He's still open to new information, and counting out the chips, I'm not sure that this was a deliberate strategy on Todd's part to take a few seconds and give the villain a chance to like make a mistake by getting talkative, but I think it works out nicely that way anyway. And I think you know, unless it truly is a trivial call, like if you have the nuts, you shouldn't take your time to call. But you, in this kind of situation where there actually is the opportunity to get some new information and fold, and we'll talk about whether the fold is good in a second, but you just, the fact that you might want to fold, I think it makes sense to give yourself that couple of seconds to, you know, A, think, and B, give your opponent the opportunity to give you some information, as ended up happening here. I agree with Todd's interpretation of the villain, like, suddenly talking in a jovial kind of way, especially a tight, aggressive kind of player. I think the talking is really a sign of relaxation. So I think a player like that is not going to be comfortable if he's sticking his whole stack in there, even if he has a great semi-bluffing hand, like, even if he has Queen Jack of Spades, right? Where he's got like a gutter and a flush draw. I still think that he's going to be nervous with that much money at risk. And it's just like from Todd's description of this player, he sounds like someone who's going to be a little uncomfortable playing a really big pot. And again, I'm also thinking back to that comment about not having the cojones to three barrel. So I think it's a pretty bad sign that the villain is this talkative, and it comes back to my initial point about what were you really looking to accomplish by betting here? Like, either he's checking to fold, if he is checking to get it in, like, if he is check-raising all in here, I don't know that there's really too many hands you're happy about him doing that with, and I don't even see him doing a whole lot of check-calling, but yeah, I think it's a pretty bad sign that he seems confident here and that he wants to check raise all in on this board. I kind of doubt that he has ace jack in his range. Even queen jack of spades seems pretty unlikely to me for, you know, three betting to $40 pre-flop as opposed to just calling, which I think would be very appealing in his shoes if he's holding queen jack of spades. So I wouldn't even expect to see a hand like that much. And I think it's pretty great that Todd has the discipline to fold this. I think it's a good fold. I do really wish we had not bet the flop. But other than that, yeah, I think it's a great fold. In terms of folding face up, it's not really something I'm a big fan of doing. I understand that people do this because they want their opponent to show their hand as well. If you really feel like you're going to get valuable information from seeing your opponent's hand, fine. I think, though, that it feels a little like a crutch to me. Like, it feels like, why do you need to see his hand? Why do you need this validation that you made the right fold? Even if the villain shows you queen jack of spades, are you really learning? I mean, I guess you're learning that you could have queen jack of spades in his range. I suppose that's useful information. The villain ends up showing king, so, you know, we see that he has a set, and that's just kind of, I mean, it's the sort of hand I would have expected him to have anyway when he takes this line, sort of like aces, kings, and ace king. I would expect to be pretty prominently in his range when he does this. So, like, seeing one of those hands doesn't really give me new information. You, however, have given your opponent some information, for better or for worse. I mean, I realize a lot of your players at 1-2 aren't really going to be able to make good use of this information anyway. I guess it just feels a little, just kind of like a psychological weakness to me, that you need to get this validation of seeing your opponent's cards rather than just trusting that you made the right read and not worrying about the results, right? In the same way that if you get it in with kings versus ace king and the ace comes, right, you don't want to beat yourself up over that. The same sort of thing, like, if you make the right fold here, even if it turns out the villain didn't have it this time, you still probably made the right decision based on the information that you had at the time. So seeing those cards, maybe it provides some useful information about the opponent, but I think it has at least as much potential to tilt you if he does show you a bluff. And I think fundamentally you shouldn't need that validation. You should just trust in your own reads, and the cards that the opponent had this time don't even actually matter that much, because you're playing against a range of hands and not just one hand. So whether or not he had it this time just shouldn't be an important thing to you. And my worry is that you're babying yourself a little bit. Rather than developing the like mental toughness to deal with the uncertainty, you're just sort of like, well, let's just not have the uncertainty. Let's just see what those cards were. Not to mention the opponent's not required to show them to you when you show your hand. I mean, there's various game flow reasons why if it's like a friendly game and people are showing cards, maybe you want to participate in that too. But I really discourage you from showing cards. Todd goes on to say, I need to get better at determining stack size, and I once asked the dealer how much someone had. He said he couldn't answer. I then asked the player and didn't get a clear answer from him, which kicked off a table debate. I think, though, in that situation, Todd is not talking about a situation where a player had bills on the table. I'm pretty sure with the bills on the table, you should be allowed to get a count on those, because that's not really something that you can eyeball. Todd also says, otherwise I played well, value town myself a few times going for thin value, also got stuck with two short stack players on my immediate left for too long. I won a number of pots with air, my c-bet frequency was very high, but people were folding so often. Also managed to take a pot away on the river when a flush draw hit and the opponent showed weakness. Oh well, great content on the podcast. I really enjoyed a hand recently where you both went on for 20 plus minutes talking about one street. Amazing amount can be learned from it. Thank you. Well, thank you, Todd. You know, we probably get more complaints than we do compliments specifically about like the depth of the strategy segments. Not that we don't get plenty of nice comments about the show, but you know, a fair number of kind of less serious poker players have told me, oh, hey, I checked out that poker podcast and my God, you guys talk so long about one hand. So it is nice to hear that, that some people don't mind us going into so much depth on one hand or even one decision. There's times when even I feel like it's dragging on a little bit and we tried to hurried along sometimes, but this is a long-form poker podcast, and the strategy is long-form also. Thank you also, Todd, for listening and for writing. Very interesting hand. Thank you, everyone else, for listening. And let's go talk to American housewife Helen Ellis. So, Helen, is it? I think some people might bristle at being introduced as a housewife, but is that the moniker that you prefer? It seems like you've taken it on for yourself.
I embraced the word housewife for quite a long time. My mother was a housewife before she went to law school in her 40s. Before that, her mother was a housewife. Before that, her mother was a housewife. And for me, especially at a poker table, when asked what I do, I always say housewife, because when I say that, it stops a second question. Nobody, you know, unless they ask you what you do all day. What do you do all day? But usually it's just shut.
You've got a whole Twitter account to answer that.
Usually the answer is whatever I want, but it gives me a sense of privacy. And I really am proud of that. I've been with my husband for over 20 years, and I haven't always been a housewife, but I have been, I would say, for the last 10 years. And I take pride in the house. I take pride in my role in the marriage, and I take pride in my privacy. So yeah, I have no problem with that. But I also call myself a feminist. So there you go.
So what do you?
Wife and a feminist.
So what do you do all day?
What do I do all day? Well, right now it's a very unusual time. I have a new book coming out in 2019. So I'm about 10 pages away from finishing it. And so
congratulations.
Thank you. So I'm writing a good 3 to 5 hours a day. And then otherwise, I'm cleaning the grout in the kitchen or making supper or clipping the cat's nails or you know, going to dinner, going to a show. It's a nice life.
You haven't even mentioned poker yet.
Well, I would never do that in the privacy of my own home. That's an outside activity. I am always plotting the next trip, and it really works well with the writing because the poker is like a carrot at the end of the stick. So I'm plotting to finish the final draft of the book before April Fool's Day, and then I'm going to run off to, when I say run off, I mean climb onto the back of a Greyhound bus and go off to Atlantic City for the spring open.
Nice. Is that your main poker haunt?
Borgata is my main poker haunt, but I do play every January and September with my father at the Beau Rivage in Biloxi. He's in Alabama, so I fly down, he drives over, and we've been going there for just ages and ages. I love the Beau.
That's a nice tradition. And, you know, I think a lot of people, or it's not so uncommon to hear, like, father-son poker stories. Yeah. This might be the first father-daughter. Well, I guess there's Doa Brunson and his daughter plays a little bit, maybe, or used to play a little bit. But, yeah, you don't hear a lot of these father-daughter poker stories.
Yeah, my father is a poker player. His father was a poker player. And when I was 6 years old, I have very vivid memories of sitting down at Granddaddy's dining room table, pushing aside the Lazy Susan full of salad dressing, and learning between the two of them how to play seven-card stud. And when I was 21, my father met me in Vegas. We stayed at the Mirage, which was brand new. You know, Siegfried and Roy were brand new in their entirety. At that point, I would sit behind him and watch him play. But I remember very vividly, he took me at midnight to the Strip. We sat on Caesar's statue. It's pitch black dark except for all the lights on the Strip and all the stars in the sky. And he said, "Helen Michelle, look around. This is the center of the universe." And I, so ever since then, for the last 20-something years, we meet for father-daughter poker.
That's interesting. My sort of stereotype of a Southern father might be wanting to protect his belle from the horrors of the male at the poker table.
I was the only girl in the entire baseball league because he agreed to coach. I was taught to shoot a gun off the back of a boat. I had one of those fathers. I have one of those fathers.
So, but you don't, I mean, was that a joke about not playing poker in your house, or do you, I thought I saw a picture in one of the New York Times articles where you were hosting a game.
If I play poker in my house, that means I play poker in my house with my husband, and various groups of friends, and it is not uncommon. It's happened more than once where I have thrown everyone out of the house for behaving badly. So in my house, manners trump poker cards.
What would constitute behaving badly?
Oh, Lord. A lot of crass talk. It used to be in one of my games, you have to train men to behave. And so, and it's always men. For a very long time in one of my games, if you said something insulting or what you thought was just being funny in my direction, you had to pay me $1. But then it turned around. If you said something nice to me, like, "Oh, Helen, thank you for that massive pop, but you look so very, very pretty," I would give you $1. And now all I get is compliments, and I lose the most money that way. But I take it.
Is that kind of a conscious effort on your part to... I mean, it seems like kind of an uphill battle for a poker table to say, "Oh, people have to have, you know, good manners and no crass talk." And I mean, I think for a lot of people, that's sort of the opposite of what they're looking at. Like, they play poker precisely so they can have a space to do those things.
Yeah, it's a very different game in my house than in a casino. In a casino, I do not speak unless spoken to. And I would never say, you know, "Check yourself before you..." because in my experience, I'm not one to say, "Don't speak to me that way," because I judge who you are in the manner that you speak to me. If you, call me honey or sweetheart, or you say, that lady, I'll say, doesn't matter what a squeeze play is, you know, I don't say a word because it helps me judge who you are. And a lot of the times in a casino, it's really interesting. If there's usually one player who acts up, is rude, is volatile, comes at me, and I won't say anything. And most of the time, other men at the table will step in and defend me. And oftentimes, other men at the table will target the player who's being abusive and just take him out for me. So it's an interesting dynamic. I behave a lot differently at home than I would in a casino.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're definitely fighting an uphill battle in a casino. And I think, well, I mean, I guess I would also draw a distinction between, I mean, it seems like some of what you're talking about was the sort of rudeness targeting you specifically or targeting you as a woman or something like that, as opposed to just someone, you know, cursing after losing a pot, not directing it at anyone, but just sort of.
Every time I sit down at the table, and I've been playing in casinos since I was 21 and playing tournaments for 10 years, and every time I sit down at a table, I'm immediately targeted as the weakest player because I'm a woman, unless people know me. And then I just sit quietly, and once, you know, I draw first blood, change their opinion. Because I'm extreme, you know, I'm extremely selectively aggressive. I'm very aggressive at the table. And it's nice. It's really one of the few places I feel comfortable being so confrontational. And again, very quiet, very mannerly, but very, very tough. And so I have to gain respect in that way, not by shooting my mouth off.
Does that get dicey? I mean, I can imagine playing with your husband if both of you are sort of competitive or whatever.
It's lose-lose for him. if he loses, he loses. And if he wins, he loses.
Right.
One time sometimes you end up at the same table. We'll play tournaments. It's really a rare occurrence, but I have a very vivid memory. We were at the Aria years ago. He pushed us all in. I looked at it, aces, and I just looked across the table and said, sorry, dear. I turned over my aces. He turned over his kings. He hit his king, and I, you know, cheered like a little girl. So I crack him so often.
are tournaments your thing exclusively?
I'm a much more comfortable tournament player. I do like cash, but it's a whole different skill set. Tournaments, I like the one, you know, the last man standing or last woman standing aspect of it. And I like it. Once you get over, in my opinion, if I make it over the, you know, $200, $400 blind level, I'm good. Okay. Once we get after that level, it's sort of dog eat dog, and I love it. It can be aggressive and knock everybody.
Do you play much stud anymore?
I love horse tournaments. That's the most chance I get to play outside of a home game. I played, the last horse tournament I played was the World Series last summer, and I think I busted in the 40s, and it was fantastic. I love it. I love stud. I love horse. I hate Omaha. Usually in a horse tournament, when the Omaha round comes around in those 2 hours, that's when I choose to run to the ladies' room.
How much World Series of Poker do you get to do each year?
The first time we went, I think, was 2010, and we've gone every year since. We usually go for a week, and now we've been going at the beginning, because usually that's when the horse tournament is. I really do love to play it. And this year and the last year we went, you know, at the end trying to win our way in. You know, I think of Carlos and his nittiness. And I'm not very nitty when it comes to a hotel or a meal, but I'm very nitty when it comes to putting my money into a tournament. So I've yet to play the main event at the World Series because I go out and I try to, mega satellite in. I give myself two shots, and if I don't make it, I go home. And that's what's happened the last couple. I have a really nice meal before I do.
You did get to coach Colson Whitehead for the main event.
It's like the thrill of my life. I was a super fan of his writing and still am. And when I was given that opportunity You know, it was probably the nicest gift I've ever gotten was my girlfriend, Hannah Tinty, whose novel, The 12 Lives of Samuel Hawley, is just out in paperback. A little bit of cover in it. Thank you. She was in a small game with him and a bunch of writers, and he was looking for a coach, and she very kindly offered me up, and it was a great, great experience.
Oh, so you didn't even know him. That was like a secondhand recommendation.
No. I mean, he would be at a party here, a party there, but no, I'd never said anything more than, you know, nice to meet you. it was a thrill. And then to see, and at that point, I wasn't writing. So I really was just this poker playing housewife. And well, I don't want to say just, I was a poker playing housewife. and to see someone who's an artist write about you in this sort of badass way, it gave me a real boost of confidence in the poker world. I started playing more than I was. And it gave me a real boost of confidence to write American Housewife, because I thought to myself, well, if I had the nerve to walk into a room where there's 3% women and think I can be the last one standing, then I can write a little story. So I really do credit him for reminding me that I could be brave after really being dormant in my creative life for many, many years.
Well, and we should fill in a little backstory here, and I'll start with Colson, but I certainly want to talk about your writing as well.
Start with the Pulitzer winner.
So, I mean, for people who don't know, right? I mean, this is a writer who I think didn't really have much poker experience and decided he wanted to play the main event and write about it. So was it, I mean, I imagine that's an intimidating task for you to take on, to say, I'm going to, you know, having not played the main event yourself, you know, I'm going to help this other person prepare for it. Was that intimidating
for me? Of course it was, but I just said yes, I'll do it. And it is a lot less intimidating when you do have, well, I did have more experience and I had, you know, been there, so it was not as, you know, it wasn't as intimidating as, I don't know, so as in coaching someone else. But I think for him, it was less intimidating because, you know, you look at me, I'm not a serious looking person, and I love to teach beginners. I do, I teach a lot of ladies groups to play. So I have a lot of patience when it comes to teaching someone, and I really love the game. And I want you to love it too. So I want him to love it too. And he was a good study, you know, and I was so, so proud. So, you know, if I told him to read a book, he'd read the book. If I told him to play a sit and go, he'd say, what's a sit and go? And then he'd go and play the sit and go. And then, my main goal, my first goal for him was just make it through day one. And he did it. And he busted with like ace versus king. So what else could I have asked for? He made me very proud.
When you're teaching, I mean, any new player to play, you know, as you said, you've taught a lot of them. What do you focus on for it? What do you see as kind of the things that, for people who are mostly interested in poker in sort of a social or pretty casual context, well, what do you try to introduce them to first?
If I'm teaching you to play in a tournament, say you're going to go in and play, you know, play a $100, you know, daily tournament, my advice is, never enter a pot unless you're raising or re-raising. It just keeps you in line. It keeps you from opening weak hands. You know, if someone raises in front of you and you look down at Jack 10 suited, you're going to either three bet with that or you're going to fold. That's the first bit of advice. The second bit of advice is when you know you're outmatched, and if you're new to the game, you probably are outmatched, play in position. At least it gives you that bit of an edge. And then the third bit of advice is, if you get down to 20 bigs, you have one decision to make. You're shoving or you're folding. You're shoving over or you're folding. And then once you get much more experienced and you learn your table, then I might give you a little leeway. But I try to keep it simple for beginners.
It sounds like you have a fair number of friends who have said, "Oh, hey, Ellen knows about her." Sorry, Helen knows about Helen knows about poker. Is that a kind of a common thing that you have people coming to you and sort of asking, "Hey, how about this poker thing?"
They do, but then, you know, poker, I assure you, as you well realize, poker is a game of patience. It's patience and position. And the thing about poker, the way I play, is sometimes you're just sitting there for an hour and you're just folding and folding and folding. Mm. And folks don't like to do that. And so...
No, they don't. they
say, "But Helen, you know, I had an ace and a seven off suit. I saw an ace. That's not, no. And they just have no patience. So they realize it's not for them. They think it's all very exciting in a world of, you know, straight flush beaten by a straight flush. it's just not. So they usually lose interest and go back to needlepoint or bridge. And me, I am a bridge player who plays poker to support my bridge habit.
This might be a good time for Nate to jump in if he's not otherwise.
have you been playing bridge your whole life?
God, no. I started playing bridge. I started playing bridge in the time where I wasn't writing. And I thought, well, again, what am I going to do all day? Well, I'll take up bridge. That's what ladies do on the Upper East Side, right? So I'll take it up. And bridge is 1,000 times harder than poker. And it goes against every natural instinct that serves me well in poker. But I'm still playing. But, you know, bridge, you have to work with a partner. You have to believe your partner. It's very difficult to lie or bluff. And poker, it's just my natural... It's a more natural state of mind for me where I think everyone is lying to me. and bridge players, somebody said bridge is a social game for unsocial people. And that is true. There are some very peculiar people who play bridge. So I'm still learning. It is so hard.
I had no idea that was a thing, like Upper East Side bridge games. That's
yes, it's the legal underground world of Upper East Side cutthroat bridge. Don't let the tea sandwiches and Chardonnay fool you.
I must have missed that episode of Gossip Girl.
I didn't watch Gossip Girl. I can't. I don't know the reference. I'm sorry.
There's a lot of memorization involved.
Yes, yeah. There's a lot of counting, and there's a lot of signaling, and a lot of strategy, and you know, method, Jacobi method, and all this stuff that you have to memorize. It is hard.
over time, is there less and less bridge? Like in places in the country where I see bridge still being played. They tend to, it's a little bit like seven card stud, where some players are, as they say, getting called to the main game and new ones are not replacing them. Is bridge in New York City like that?
I think bridge is pretty hot in New York City right now. We had, from what I understand, I came into bridge, I would say 2014, and there were two main bridge clubs, one on the west side, one on the east side, and the east side, I think, bought the West Side's club. So these two clubs have combined. And when I say club, I am talking about two office floors next to Bloomingdale's. And that place is packed to the gills every day. And my uncle is, a master, grandmaster bridge player and plays in Georgia and tours, you know, goes on tournament tours. It seems really hot, but it's something that I think you wouldn't know about unless you were playing it. But it's popular. I know that they're trying to bring it into schools. I think they say it skipped a generation. You know, my grandmother always played it. I love bridge because, unlike poker, I'm one of the youngest women in the room, and it's primarily women. I'm like, poker. So, you know, bridge is my Botox. So my father didn't play bridge, and now, you know, I'm playing, and I think they're trying to put it into the schools. You know, I know, Gates and Buffett are trying to bring it into the schools, because it is, you know, I remember when I signed up for it, we were asked, why are you taking it? And there were two reasons. I had my own reason, but the other two popular reasons was, one, it wards off Alzheimer's, which is true. Mm-hmm. And two, when my husband dies, I want to have friends to play with. And my answer was, I want to have a game where I don't lose money. But I do lose money in bridge because you have to play, you know, you have to pay to play, you know, duplicate. And then I think once I start playing for points, I'm going to get better. You know, you have to put a dollar amount for me to get interested. But it really is true. I have to play poker to support my bridge habit.
Yeah, it was my Southern grandmother who ultimately got me into bridge.
Yes, that's right. A Southern grandmother. Mine, you know, there was always a card table set up for her bridge ladies to come over. And there was a really good book that came out, I think, 2 years ago called The Bridge Ladies by Betsy Lerner. And it was about a woman in her 50s getting to know her mother's bridge group of 40 years. And it was just a fantastic read.
When you were talking before, Ellen, I keep doing that, sorry, Helen, about patience, you know, I was thinking just what little bit I had read or heard about your literary career, that some of that must be resonating there as well.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah, I had a book come out in 2000. It did really well. I thought I was sort of on my way. At 29, then I wrote another book, and nobody wanted to publish it. And then I wrote another book, and nobody wanted to publish it. And then I wrote another book, and nobody wanted to publish that. And then I quit writing for 2 or 3 years. And then I started this anonymous Twitter account, because when I would say housewife, people would say, what do you do all day? And I started this Twitter account called What I Do All Day. And I sort of got my voice back and started writing short stories based on tweets I was sending out, quietly getting them published in literary magazines. And then in 2016, American Housewife was published. So there was a 15-year lull of, you know, failure. So again, I do think poker helps with disappointment and patience. You know, I was just at the Borgata for the WPT, and, you know, I, of course, being the poker nit that I am, I played one $350 mega and won my seat into the main, and, you know, chewed my way into day two, chewed my way, you know, close to the bubble. Sat down next to my friend Jamie Kersetter, so thrilled to play with her for hours and hours on end, and then promptly, like 10 minutes later, busted in the worst fashion. So embarrassing, so angry at myself, just furious for probably a good day. And then I shook it off. And I think it served well with other, you know, other, what's the word, facets of my life, like submitting stories to be published or a bad book review. I just shake it off. So I do thank poker for giving me a thicker skin.
Do you, I mean, you used the word failure to describe the sort of the 15 years when you hadn't mm-hmm. published anything. I mean, do you think that's really an accurate term as opposed to like practice or something like that?
That's very positive of you to say practice. And it is practice, but I'm not, it's like the word housewife. I'm not afraid or ashamed of the word housewife, and I'm not afraid or ashamed to fail. I think if you're not failing, you're not trying. And I think you learn more from failures and you appreciate the success when it comes all the more. I know it's a politically correct time in the world, but you know, you do fail. that's just the word for it. That's just the word. So I embrace it because, again, with the book I'm writing now, I never thought I'd be writing another book. So I don't have a lot of fear associated with it. If I fail, I still have a very nice life. I'll go back. I'll make a grilled cheese sandwich and, you know, go on with things. So, the more you fail, the more you learn. It's not fun. There are some tears, but, you know, that's life.
All right, let me come at it one more way. So I could see there's were the books did they not turn into? Sorry, what was that?
I said you're trying to make me feel better, but I feel fine.
Well, okay, this could easily make you feel worse, but I'll ask anyway. were the books not what you wanted them to be, or was it that they were what you wanted them to be, and that just wasn't what anyone else wanted to read?
I think it was both. I think, somebody said, this is classic description of the sophomore slump. You have a success with the first book and then the second book fails. Mm-hmm. So my second, third, and fourth book failed, but nobody saw it other than, all the publishers who were rejecting it. And I think there was, with the second, third, and fourth book, there was this mentality where I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted to write, important books. I wanted to be Colson Whitehead, but I'm not Colson Whitehead. I'm Helen Ellis. And it really did take all those failures for me to write something I knew. And it turns out writing something is a lot easier. I mean, with American Housewife, every story is about a housewife, so I know what it is to be alone, with your own devices all day long and get into trouble, but I don't know what it is to murder three doormen, or I don't know what it is to start a book club that's really a secret surrogacy ring, but I don't know what it is to ferry, runaway toddler in tiaras. I think the failure sometimes, it brought me back to my own voice. I was writing books that weren't right for me, and I was writing books that weren't right for anybody else because they probably weren't reading authentically. Mm-hmm. And people ask me, would you go back into that, metaphorical drawer and pull out the old novels to publish? And the answer is absolutely not. I'm glad they never saw print.
Have you written about poker at all?
Yes. Poker is in both books that are out. So in the first book, Eating the Cheshire Cat, instead of a ladies' bridge game in the South, there's a ladies' poker game, and someone loses a finger. And then in American Housewife, there's a story called How to Be a Patron of the Arts. And it's about a woman who decides to stop writing. And one of the things she does when she stops writing is play poker. And that's pretty close to the bone because the poker playing opens up, new people and new worlds to her. In real life, some of the most interesting people I've ever met are card players. It's a world I would never, I would never sit down with, Kevin Saul or Matt Matros in any other arena other than sitting down with them at a poker table.
Have you gotten to be friends with people, like the people who, you wouldn't meet in any other sphere, but you've met them at the poker table and then you've become, friends who have interacted in other places?
Definitely. I do think about Kevin. Kevin Saul I met I call him my poker Yoda. I met him in 2010. I had gone out there to Vegas for the first time to play the World Series, and I played that daily deep stack for, you know, $250 or whatever it is, and came in third at 5 in the morning for 10 grand. And my husband, God only knows why, said, oh, play the tournament, you know, whatever the No Limit tournament is the next day. And I go down to register, and it's not a $1,500 tournament. It's a $5,006 max. And he says, what? I don't know if I would ever do it again. So I plopped down my little 5K brick and sat down in a shark tank. And I knew, you know, certain players, you know, like I knew who Phil Ivey was. I knew who, the big names were, but there was this kid in a blue hoodie tearing at the table, but I sort of gave it right back to him in my little purple Diane von Furstenberg dress. And at the intermission, he said, "The hell are you?" And I said, "Housewife." And he said, "Bullshit." And he has been sort of a, you know, he was one of the first professionals to show me respect, and to say, "You're not a housewife, you're a poker player." So he, you know, he's been a great sort of spiritual guy for me. And then through Colson's book, I met Matt, who coaches me outside, who coaches me for poker. And he's the opposite of Kevin. You know, he's very mathematical, he's very analytical. You know, before Matt, I was very much an instinctive player, and Matt really opened me up, in terms of range and statistics and that sort of thing. And Matt is very involved in the literary world. So, you know, I see him on a social basis, through literary friends. And, but most of the time, you know, and then again, you meet interesting people in home games, that you wouldn't normally meet. Someone's always bringing somebody in. But every time I go play cards at a casino, it's like summer camp in a way. And as my husband says, it's the one area of our life where every other area of our life, I'm, you know, Mrs. Harris, Lex's wife. And at the casino, he's Helen's husband. It's a really nice, you know, alternate universe that I love.
How much do you enjoy the, you talked about Matt introducing you to the more kind of mathematical side of the game. Is that interesting to you, or is that kind of the opposite of what you initially got interested in poker for, or both, I guess?
It's really interesting to me. You know, every time I meet with them, there's a spreadsheet. it's really interesting because like I say, he really opened up my range. I was a much tighter player before I met him, and then, you know, I'm learning from him, and he's telling me, oh yes, you want to open with you know, suited gappers, middle range. And I will tell you, some of my biggest wins have been, oh, I'm on the button and there's two bets in front of me, and I, you know, three bet with 7-5 of hearts and flop a monster, and no one gives me credit for it. So that is thanks to him for opening that up. And then things like just opening my calling range, things like that.
Aside from the people that you've talked to, what are the tools that you've used to learn more about poker?
The first books I read were, and I still recommend them, were Harrington on Hold'em. I think those books are very user-friendly and really help you understand stack size and how to play. I mean, the game has changed dramatically from, you know, betting 5x in first position. I remember going to, I think it was a 2011 World Series, and seeing that the game had changed. People were opening 2.5x. So those were the first books I read. I loved Annie Duke's poker book. I love Jonathan Little's poker books. I love Phil Gordon's, you know, little books. What else? I love Phil Hellmuth's, you know, book on all the games that play poker like a pro. You know, it's a really good book for the, you know, for horse players. And it's really user friendly. And I'm always looking for a new book. You know, I know there are a lot of websites and places to watch people practice by. You know, this is my first Skype ever, so I'm not a person to learn online. I know I should, but I like, you know, I'm a book learner, or I'm a conversation. You know, I like listening to, you know, you guys analyze hands. I learn through conversation, and I learn mostly through, I don't want to say practice, through play, you know, and through watching. So, you know, you sit at a poker table and you don't play for a long time, and I sit there and I don't have headphones on, I don't have sunglasses on. If I'm not in the hand, I'm watching you play, so that when I play against you, I'll know best how to play. So, you know, I learn through books and watching.
I find it, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that they learn from, you know, playing with people who are better than they are, or just play differently or whatever. And I've always found that so difficult, just because it's so rare that you see a hand go to showdown that it's kind of hard to know what someone was doing, even if they re-raise. You're like, well, maybe you just had aces there.
That's
like,
because you are not a lady at the poker table. Let me tell you, men like to show me their cards. If someone is, you know, and if you're going to show me your cards, I'm going to look at them. It's like someone putting a little kitten in your lap. I'm going to look. It is a lot of that where someone, and sometimes it's against me, you know, but there'll be a big, big hand and someone will give me a little peek. I'm going to look so I know what they're doing. If you give someone else a little peek at the table, I'm going to ask the dealer to see your hand. But nobody, you know, again, it's this thought of like men like to, mansplaining, men like to teach you. And if you want to teach me for free, you teach me for free. That's fine. I'm happy to get a lesson.
So it seems like you kind of benefit from having this image of being like non-threatening or maybe even in need of help.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't play in that manner, but yeah, I'll, and a lot of times it's, you don't play like a woman, which in one way is really, this is what it is. You don't play like a girl. And that's right. I play like a grown woman. I think there's a respect level begins to grow when I'm at a table. And sometimes it really works in my advantage. So like during a poker tournament, it happens all the time. You know, new players will come into the table and I'll play back at them. And other men at the table will say, she always has it. Or, you know, we'll push that person out. I shouldn't be telling you these things. it happens all the time. It's really, really interesting how men play with women.
You know, I worry I might have told this story on the air before, but I was at a kind of training camp, and we were kind of talking strategy in the morning, and then we were all going to be playing together on an RFID table in the afternoon. And I was talking with a woman who was relatively new to poker, and I was telling her, you know, I think it is, or, you know, she was agreeing, but, you know, that I think a lot of men do kind of look at women and almost can't help it, but look at them as sort of like, they're going to be good bluff targets. I'm going to be able to run you over. And she, you know, kind of agreed with that. And sure enough, I did, even after having had that conversation with her just hours before, I ran a sort of, you know, big crazy bluff one in the afternoon. And, you know, she called me down with a very weak hand, and I just sort of, you know, just being aware of it wasn't enough to stop me from doing it.
Yeah, that's what Oprah says, you know, people tell you who they are, and you told her who you were, and she I mean, I do the same thing. Like I keep notes to myself, and I have a mantra: don't play in the blinds. You know, I'm too aggressive when the to if I'm in a blind, I'm either folding or I'm three betting, because if I just call on a blind, I'm going to be too aggressive, you know, and I'm going to lose. And I do it over and over where, okay, I'll just call right here with a 7-9, and then there's a 9, you know, and then I have to bet at it, and then I lose half my stack. And I you know, so I do the same thing. I know my weakness, and I continue to do it.
I'm curious, do you have a particular goal for the Twitter account? Like, I mean...
Oh, a goal for the Twitter account? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Nobody's ever asked me that. Well, my original goal for the Twitter account, what I do all day, is to practice writing. You know, I do not engage with anyone online. I mean, you and I met, introduced ourselves over Twitter years ago, but it was through direct message. So, you know, like if you retweet something I say, you know, I'll write you a very private little thank you note or that sort of thing. But I don't engage and I don't really read Twitter. I just use it for the voice. So if you go to the account, you'll just see a strong voice. And that's, so that was my first goal. And the second goal, it's a tool to help gain readers. And it's, you know, it's just, it's a way to be out there and not fully out there. You know, it still sort of is anonymous. My picture's not on it. You know, it's...
Oh, that's not you?
No! It would have been me in 1953. You know, full girdle and a perm. Which is a great look. I'm waiting for that 1950s perm to come back around. You know, forget it. and so that's my, those are the goals, is to keep the voice going, to keep that practice going, and stay in touch and, you know, and gain a following when it comes to the books. If you like the way the Twitter account sounds, you'll like the way the stories are told, I think.
Is there anything in particular that you feel like you're trying to say with that voice?
These are your good literary questions, not poker questions. It's very good.
this is a literary show in disguise as far as I'm concerned.
I love it. I'm going to ask a lot of questions. What am I trying to say with it? I'm trying to be honest and funny and kind. I'm trying to... it's almost... I'm trying to be honest and funny and kind. I'm trying to, in a way, be an introvert activist. I am, you know, very comfortable saying the word housewife because I am very comfortable being alone in my home. But I also am a feminist. But I don't like crowds. So in a way, it's my voice. It's my way of saying, you know, I do every so often I write something called How to Be a Feminist, and it's just a quiet way to be strong. So, for example, how to be a feminist when someone, you know, when you're giving someone a compliment on their work, don't belittle your own work. Like you would say, you know, Phil Ivey is a great poker player, but I'm not a great poker player. There's no reason to belittle your own work to raise someone else up. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, how to be a feminist. You know, when you see a woman's name trending on Twitter, it is never for a good reason. It is never for a good reason. She is either dead, but she's never dead. She's being fat shamed. She's being shamed for the way she performs. She's being shamed for her sexuality. It's never good. So you don't click that link. You don't participate. You don't, you know, feed into, you know, Jennifer Aniston's divorce. You know, you are respectful. So it's just, it's my quiet way of getting my point across. Even if that point is, you know, I love aerosol hairspray. I don't know. my drug of choice, you know.
Well, part of what motivated that question is I read the title or what I kind of thought when I first started looking at it or found out that it existed, that it was kind of a satirical, like, or satirizing what people, like, stereotypes of a housewife or something like that. I think there is some of that, but it seems like you want to defend some of that too, or say, you know, these are good things. These aren't things that need to be skewered.
Yeah, you know, everybody says that, not everybody, but a lot of people say, oh, you know, the Twitter account is like a 1950s housewife on steroids, or, you know, the short story collection is satirical. And it's never been my intention to be satirical. but, you know, when I put something out there, it's for the reader to decide what it is. It's just nice to be heard.
Well, I mostly just thought that the name, the what I do all day tag, which I guess I understand is sort of because that's a question you get asked a lot. But I feel like, that name has to be a little tongue-in-cheek.
It was in direct response to being asked that at every cocktail party, and if I, because when people meet you at cocktail parties, they ask, it's really interesting. My husband and I will go to go into a new environment, and they ask him, what do you do? And they ask me, how many kids do you have? Or, they don't even ask me what I do. And the answer is none. And then that really sets them down. What do? I'm a housewife. And that just, what do you do all day? And it was just this response. And I didn't even tell my husband I was doing the Twitter account until I got 100 followers. I didn't tell anyone. I've had two, writing partners for 20-some years, Hannah Tinti and Anna Politano, who are both novelists in their own right. And I didn't tell them until I had 100 followers, because I hadn't been writing, and it was just sort of secret thing. When I did say, tell my husband, I have something to tell you, he was terrified. And then he found out I had opened an anonymous Twitter account, and then he said, please don't ever, ever introduce something to me that way again.
When you tell people you're a poker player at parties, they think it's appropriate to ask how much money you make.
Exactly. And I never say that either. I never say that either. Other people, you'll be in a group and, oh, what do you do? And there are a lot of things I can say I do, but, I don't have to lay it all out there. And I do always say housewife because, let me give you some advice. If someone says, I'm a housewife, instead of saying, what do you do all day, ask them, oh, have you read any good books? Ask them something specific. But, again, it's a situation where I'll say that and someone else will jump in. Oh, no, she's not. She's a writer or she's a poker player. But, I know all that. I don't need to put it out there. So I don't say poker player. I don't.
Do you have poker goals? Things that you're hoping to do that you haven't done yet?
I want to play the main event. I'll have to win my way in because the housewife in me won't allow me to put 10 grand down. I have to win it. That's the biggest goal, and that's a goal that could happen this year. So that's my goal for this year. And then I have, Hendon Mob goals. Like I wanted to get over 100,000, and I did that. And I want to play more. It is an addiction. I don't play online because I would be 300 pounds and sitting in like a pile of cat food cans and laundry. So I really only play when I go to the casinos, and which is interesting because I do find safety in a casino. I feel very safe. There are underground clubs in New York, and I've done that in the past. I don't feel safe. In a casino, I feel safe. So the goals are to play more, but everything in moderation, and the biggest gamble has been writing, and that's taken a lot of time the last 3 years, which I'm very happy that it's taken a lot of time, but it's taken me off the poker circuit. Mm-hmm. But I'll be there this summer. I cannot wait. Hopefully in April in the Borgata.
The book that you're working on now, is that also short fiction?
The book I'm working on now was sold based on I wrote an essay for Modern Love in the New York Times called Making a Marriage Magically Tidy, and it was about how I became a recovering slob to save my marriage. my publisher, on the strength of that, bought a collection of essays. So the book is like American Housewife, except everything is true. You're going to find out why.
Any poker in this one?
Is there any poker in this one? There is, I published a piece for Garden and Gun magazine last summer about my trips to Biloxi with my father, father-daughter poker trips. So that will probably be in it. But sometimes poker is too close to me to write about. I do want to write about it, but it's still too close for me. It's a secret pleasure, and I like keeping it secret. Although
we might have just ruined that in this last hour.
Oversharing, I think, with you two.
So people who want to learn more about you, there's the What I Do All Day Twitter account. You have a website or anything else like that you want to send people to?
I really am quite a Luddite, but I love my account on Twitter, What I Do All Day. And then I have an Instagram account called American Housewife. So that's where I am. I post pretty much daily. And that's where you can find me. There is a Facebook page, but I don't operate it. The publisher operates it. So those are the best places. Twitter, What I Do All Day, and Instagram, American Housewife.
Anything else you were hoping to talk about that we didn't know well enough to ask you?
No, it's great. No, you asked me lots of great things and some surprising things.
No, that's our goal. We try to be interesting because we can't offer you the kind of audience that you get when you're writing for the New York Times, but hopefully we're interesting.
If I could gain, one straight male reader out of this, that would be a huge coup.
I realized I think I just did the anti-feminist thing where I talked myself down while trying to compliment you.
You gotta up your feminist game now. Come on, you could be a feminist.
I think we have some listeners who feel otherwise. But. Well, thanks so much for talking to us, Ellen. It's been a blast, and
I will tell
hopefully
you
we'll get a chance to meet this summer.
Definitely, and I will give you one last compliment before I go. My husband is the one who found your podcast years ago, and he loves it, and he uses your voices to fall asleep to sometimes. So sometimes I'll come into her.
I suppose that's a compliment.
It is a compliment, believe me. You're like the Terry Gross of the poker world. So often I'll get into bed, and it will be me, my husband, and the voice of you. So it's the closest to a three-way I've ever done. <Thank
you. laughs> Well, now I'm really looking forward to meeting you in Vegas. All right, thanks again, Helen. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Take away the pain. Sleepless nights, do I need some kind of pill? Or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.